What's the complaint you're hearing most loudly or most often from people about an IHP review?
Well, let me give you the fine print first. Okay.
Okay.
So I'm not going to answer your question. I'm going to. The village vote isn't going to count. The fact that the most people raise their hands about something doesn't necessarily mean it's the thing that would have the most profound impact. And so I'm very hesitant to tell you what the village vote is, okay? Because I really don't know, okay? There are certain categories of things that have emerged, and I'm sure you've heard them from others. The categories are things like administrative burden. Some people report that they spend, you know, too much time either preparing or reviewing applications. Many people talk about the need to try and enhance the quality of both the review and the reviewers. There's a sense that some of the most talented, more senior individuals have opted out of participating in some study sections, not all. And then there's also a sense, because of, you know, finite budgetary resources, that some people do, you know, feel they spend way too much time, you know, preparing applications. There is a discussion about the sort of, you know, the culture of peer review. So when I was an associate professor, it was considered to be a very high honor to serve on a study section. And in fact, in many institutions, if you weren't on a study section, it was very difficult to aspire to be promoted to full professor. You know, this was sort of a rite of passage, as it were. There are many people who have reported that, you know, do we need ways to support research that it is more innovative, more transformative in nature, and do we have to look at people at different stages of their career path and provide different kinds of opportunities and indeed perhaps different types of reviews for people at different stages of their career. So there had been a time when new investigators had their own separate award mechanism. Back when I was an early career investigator, it was called an R23, that became an R29. We don't have that presently. Many have suggested that we either need something like that and or need separate review for people who are in their early career. Others at the other end of the spectrum have suggested that the best predictor of future success is past performance. So more senior or more seasoned investigators suggest that what we should consider doing is to have an application that is reviewed more on the basis of what has been accomplished as opposed to what is planned to be accomplished. Then there have been a lot of discussion about the overall system that we use to support science. And so some have asked, and I don't believe it's rhetorical, I think they're genuine in their questioning, how many R01s are enough for any one individual, and whether or not there should be, you know, some ceilings placed. In the same vein, others have reported out that they feel, their observation is that team science is still underappreciated by the current procedures that we employ. So there's this counterintuitive thing that has emerged. On the one hand, people say the problem with the current system is that we have so many reviewers in the room. We have the members of the standing study section and then many, many ad hoc reviewers who sort of parachute in and parachute out, you know, and they may review one or two or three applications. So on the one hand, people are saying we need to go back to the way it used to be, where there was a cohesive, smaller group of presumably wise men and women who, you know, oversaw the review of the applications. But on the other hand, people are saying in the current system, my application is really being decided or being reviewed by two or three individuals, you know, the so-called primary, secondary reviewers. And they point to the wisdom of the crowds, right? It, arguing that wouldn't it make more sense to have more people, you know, review? And so how do you have both, how do you do both things at the same time? So that's why a number of people have suggested that NIH consider an editorial board like model. And so and again, there are many flavors of this, but one potential flavor would be to have those formerly known as ad hoc reviewers to serve on the editorial board, and they would send in, on the basis of their content expertise, a review electronically, let's say, to the associate editors, formerly known as the charter members of the study section. And so, let's say the charter members requested four or five such reviews. Again, I'm making these numbers up. We depend on the complexity of the application, of course. Informed by those, you know, three or four or five reports by the editorial board members, then the associate editors, also who have read the application and have, you know, reached their own conclusions, could perhaps then make a much better informed decision. So there's this discussion as to whether or not that would be a more appropriate, you know, way to do things. There's been a discussion about, gets back to the strains and stresses on the system. There's been a discussion about how over time peer review has morphed into a mentoring device. So individuals read applications, and instead of simply critiquing the merits of the application as received, they want to help the applicant, and so they begin to suggest, sometimes with great specificity, certain things that could be done to enhance the application, either by addition or subtraction. The potential difficulty of this is that it can set up expectations on the part of both the reviewer and the applicant. So the applicant's expectation, which may be misguided, is, okay, if I do everything that the reviewer has suggested, send it back in, I will be rewarded by a much better score. And the reviewer may have unrealistic expectations to think, okay, I've given the benefit of my wisdom to the applicant, he or she now, I expect them to follow everything that I... So some have suggested, instead of that, why not go back to simply reviewing the merit of the application without any attempt at mentoring. Let the mentoring occur at the home institutions. And that way, you don't have these sort of false expectations that emerge on both, you know, sides.
I got mixed messages from people. People are saying there isn't enough mentoring, or people saying we shouldn't do it at all. So there are some people who are saying we should go back to mentoring, but I think from other people's perspective, we're doing it too much.
Exactly right. And honestly, there's nothing clear cut. Everybody says that, okay? I can tell you my own personal experience for what it's worth. When I was chair of a department, a major part of what I did was review other people's applications before they were submitted. And the reason we did this was we didn't want to take the chance of a, quote, bad application coming from our department. The other thing that we have heard a lot is that the feedback that they get when their application is not competitive is still too ambiguous. Some have suggested that we need a simple way of unambiguously telling an applicant that his or her application is just simply not competitive.
Bother to resubmit.
Well, yeah, in other words, not recommended for resubmission. Because even though it may be technically fine, and even though it may, you know, there's nothing wrong with it, if you will, it would have, in the estimation of the reviewers, minimal impact. Certainly, I think many investigators, if they receive that unambiguous message, would likely spend their time on, you know, other things that would, you know, be more productive, perhaps.
People have been talking about how you've gotten over 2,000 comments from the community.
Well over
that. But at the same time, then you see that there are 80,000 applications a year.
Sure.
So there is still a pretty big difference between... Are you worried that there are some sections of the community you're not hearing from?
Okay, so some of these responses were not from individuals.
Okay.
They were from whole institutions. They also came from entire professional societies. We then had these regional meetings, which we conducted around the country. And, you know, we averaged over 100 persons at each of these regional meetings.
Is there a suggestion that you're particularly excited about? Something that's come up that you think, wow, you know, I never thought of that, and that could make a big difference?
There are, but I'm not going to tell you what
okay.
it is yet. Because I don't want to potentially bias the process, which is now in a stage where we're going to begin to prioritize potential opportunities. But yes, I can tell you there have been several where I just sat and said, gee, I wish I had thought of that and didn't. You know, it's that simple.
Good.
Oh, no,
it's
wonderful.
It's the community at work.
The community at work. And I have to say, if you recall the request for information, first two questions were, you know, what are the challenges of the whole system used to support research? And what are the challenges of peer review per se? And the third question was, okay, now tell us how to solve them. And virtually everybody answered that question. And that's very heartening.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't just a bunch of folks complaining.
Yeah.
You know, this is wrong, that's wrong. No, instead, what the community did, despite, you know, their views, okay, mm-hmm. is they said, okay, and here's how I would fix this. And that's enormously helpful and, you know, speaks... volumes for the scientific community.
How are you going to study these ideas? I mean, that's the thing that people are talking about now. We'll do these pilot studies to see which suggestion will work. How do you study something like
that? So there are. First of all, what we need to do is we need to try and prioritize the challenges. And so, you know, there are many, many, many potential challenges. And so let's say we pick the top 10. I mean, I'm making all these numbers up. All right, so instead of having to find solutions for 1,000 challenges, we're going to sort of focus on finding solutions for 10 challenges or, you know, whatever the number comes out to be. Then what we need to do is we need to look at each challenge and at each potential solution and ensure by working through it with experts that the proposed intervention will in fact address or redress the challenge. Part of that will, you know, have to come through analysis here at NIH, by looking at data, by looking at experiments that institutes and centers have already done. And there have been many experiments that have already been done in NIH. Often, we think we're inventing something new, and we discover that 10 years ago somebody tried a variant on, something that's being suggested. No doubt there'll be a subset of proposed interventions that we just feel this makes sense, and you just go forward and you implement. Because the truth is, no matter what we implement, nothing is irreversible. There are very few irreversible things that one could conceive of in this context. But then there will be other things which perhaps are either more complex or require multiple things to happen simultaneously to effect, that we would consider doing pilot. And so to do a pilot, obviously, you would have to be able to articulate what the surrogate markers will be, because none of us want to do a pilot for 30 years to see if the research that's supported as a result of the intervention is better or not, okay? So we would have to be clever with surrogate markers. Some of these ideas, won't work the way perhaps, we had hoped. That's why you do experiments. That's why researchers do experiments.
What can the average biomedical researcher do to still participate in what's going on?
Well, so, look, we are never going to turn down a good idea.
Right.
Okay. I would say that, the individual out in the community, if after, looking at the website and seeing the, various presentations that are posted there, which summarize, the many, many ideas, says to themselves, well, they're not thinking about X or Y, they should contact us and say, hey, what about X or Y? I mean, that, we're not standing on ceremony here, we're not going to hide behind process. We still want to, get the very, very best ideas. I think there has been a certain amount of coalescence around themes, as I shared with you earlier. But it is absolutely possible that there's still a great idea out there, and I'd love to hear it. I think as we work through the options, the opportunity to brief the community will emerge, to get some sort of real-time feedback. Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness, don't touch that, that... we're on a fairly accelerated time frame. The NIH director has challenged us to, provide recommendations to him, by the end of February, and that is certainly what we plan on.
Why the rush? And it feels like a little bit of a rush.
I think that you can have so many wonderful ideas die the death by a thousand committees.
Yeah.
And I think that if we do our jobs correctly, and if we do the analysis properly, with so very, very many people looking at us, we have a stellar external group from the advisory committee to the director, and we have an equally stellar group internally looking at what we're doing, many institute directors, other senior leaders around the place.
So the next thing we could expect would be sometime maybe in January of seeing some kind of consolidated list of this is what we're thinking
January,
of
January, February, I think, will emerge, recommendations that no doubt will represent a coalescence between the two groups, and no doubt there will be a report of some type.
Something that we hear about so often is more money. That seems to be what a lot of scientists just sort of reflexively say they need mm-hmm. to have happen right away. Given that that's not going to happen at least within the next year, is that a big limitation on the amount of change that you can make? I mean, it seems like something that will...
Look, no matter what your budget, it's finite. And it's, the beauty of science is that you want to explore. And so, regardless of your budget, people will view it as being finite. I'll share with you something that was told to me when I first arrived at NIH 7+ years ago. One of my colleagues, Jim Batty, who's the director of the Deafness Communication Institute, told me, you don't worry about how much money you have in your budget, you worry about how wisely you spend it. And that's some of the best advice I've gotten ever. And I think it's absolutely true. And so we want peer review to help inform us as to what we support. A great deal of how we make decisions of that type is predicated upon the peer review system.